Last night we had foster parent night out. Had 48 beautiful foster kids here to hang out with, and I had my normal preschool age group that I get to know more and more every month that I spend time with them. And I have this one super high energy girl that had a great time with. We sat down in the fellowship hall, and she flipped open a Bible and was just looking for pictures in there and pointing out those things. We did puzzles together, ran around together, and she wears me out. And then by the end of those 4 hours, I go and I got to meet her family this time, and they just kind of whispered to me that they were really eager to adopt her, which is really beautiful. And I just honor them even more because they just got that four-hour break, and they're just like, we want to dive in for life with this girl. And that's just a beautiful thing to see. Lots of great stories from what God's doing in that ministry, and we're thankful for that. We understand, though, even if you're just a fill-in foster parent for 4 hours, that parenting is exhausting work. It is hard work, hands down, whether you have one or some families have eight or nine. I mean, it's all across the board, right? Parenting can just kind of wear you out. So all of us have probably felt a little bit like this next image that'll go up there, right? I was too tired to cut apple slices this morning. Please fend for yourself. And every one of us is a parent that had those fend for yourself moments. Like, just figure it out on your own somehow, some way. Hopefully, if they're old enough to use a knife, that isn't too dangerous or damaging. But if they're younger, then obviously there's a point you're just like, I need a break. I need to kind of step away. We understand, though, that having kids fend for themselves isn't really the best solution. So if you ever had a situation where you had to be away from your kids long term, and imagine when they're younger, who would you ask to fill in for you? Who would you choose to raise your kids if you could not? I want you to think about this question regardless of whether you have kids or what age they might be. If you have kids and they're older, just go ahead and go back, because if they're in high school or above, like, it maybe isn't all that big of a deal anymore. But think about when they were young. When they were in that preschool age, right? 3, 4, 5. Who would you ask to watch over them? If you don't have kids, you can still imagine, right? Look around you, the relationships you have around you. Who, if you had children of your own, and you couldn't be there for them for some extended period of time, a year plus, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, whatever it is, whatever brought you away, who would you say, these people I would trust to raise my kids? Can you just turn again, family group, gather some new friends around you, whatever it is, and just talk your way through that? Who would you pick? Why? What do you look for in those people? What would be a red flag that would be like, not you? As much as I like you and hanging out with you, you're not raising my kids. So talk together about that. Find someone around you to share. Who would you pick? We may cut you short a little bit in the conversation here. Hopefully you got enough progress on that. If you have younger kids, then you need to have the fullness of that conversation anyway. It's just really important as parents to figure that out. I won't ask you for names so that we don't embarrass or call anybody out right now, but can you at least tell me, like, what are some qualities that you would say, if I'm looking for someone who's going to fill in parenting my kids, right? Not just any kid out there somewhere, my own, the ones that I love more than any. What did you say? So they got to share the same values and be able to teach them, right? That's a really important thing. What else would you look for? All right. Faithful to Jesus. Doug? Huh? That's a good one, right? They love them. Right? I mean, that's a pretty solid one. There may be a few things. What else do we see? Yeah, spiritual growth. We talked about that, a lot of things. Anything else that we see? Kindness? Yeah, healthy, healthy enough in mind and body and everything else to be able to take care of them. They got space in their life to be able to do that too. Yeah? Financially able to support them? Young enough? Elliot made a good choice then. Yeah, right? So it is, hands down, a really weighty decision. And when you look at all of those qualities, we're like, here's the perfect parent, right, to fill in for me. Then you try to find a human being who matches those. And then it gets a lot harder, right? I know even as Melissa and I had those conversations when our kids were younger, we were like, yeah, check, check. Not. Like, who matches all of these things? We're like, Jesus, can you come and parent our kids if we die? Because I don't know who. Like, it's hard to find that perfect match, right? It's a really weighty decision, but one that God himself made 2,000 years ago. Right? Did you ever think about that? I mean, he's got his own son. And when Christmas rolls around, he's got this choice to make. Who is going to parent my kid when I'm not there for 33 years? When I'm stepped back, right? And so enter Joseph into this story. And we're working our way through Matthew. We've been on Matthew chapter 1 for a while. Matthew chapter 2 on Friday, or on Thursday night, so we'll get to keep moving ahead. But Matthew tells the story of Joseph richer and more deeply than anywhere else in the Bible. Luke picks up a lot of stuff with Mary, and she gets a lot of stuff later on. Joseph is kind of stuck in these stories here, so we've got a lot of Joseph kind of drawing out here. And there's really only a few things we know about the guy, in all honesty. We know that he is a carpenter. Matthew 13 kind of identifies that for us. At least somewhat a carpenter. The word actually is builder. It could mean a few different things, but chances are in a small enough village like Nazareth, you're not building a lot of things out of stone. So it probably was building things out of wood, whatever it needed to be built. It could have been houses, it could have been furniture, it could have been farm equipment, it could have been whatever it was. Like, he was a builder. That's what Joseph did. That was the trade that he learned from his dad, the trade that he passed on to his kid. By the time you're about 11 or 12, you learn your parents' trade. There were very few exceptions whatsoever to that. So the assumption that by the time Jesus was 12, he was learning how to be a builder or a carpenter is probably a really solid place to go, right? So we understand that about this nature of Matthew. We understand or the nature of Joseph. We understand that there is nothing about Joseph after Jesus is 12. So Luke chapter 2 has a story where they go to Jerusalem for a feast, and then Jesus hangs out in the temple, talking with everybody there, and they head on their way and like, oh, we lost our kid. Go back to pick him up, right? A familiar enough story. So that's the last time that we hear anything about Joseph. Not mentioned anywhere in the rest of the story after that. The natural assumption from that is that he probably passed away before the rest of the Jesus story gets going, when Jesus is about 30 and on to 33 when he does his ministry. But the reality is we just don't know. We don't know what happened to him. Death was a pretty common occurrence back then and easily could have occurred. There's no mention of Mary marrying anybody else or having anyone else in his life. That was just the story that we have. So nothing after Jesus is 12 that's mentioned about this kind of father role that kind of fills his life. We do understand, though, that Joseph was chosen by God to be the stepdad or Jesus' adoptive father. And I just want you to pause for a moment and give some awareness to that. I think we do a lot for Mary. The Catholic Church has pushed a whole lot on that, too. And even, honestly, most of the rest of the stories, we talk a lot about Mary as the mother of Jesus, etc. I mean, understand that God has chosen her for that role, which is true, but Joseph is equally chosen. Right? Out of all the Jewish people he could have picked, because he had to fulfill those promises, he's like, here are the ones that I'm picking to raise my son. Here are the ones that are going to teach him, that are going to teach him the values, that are going to model life for him, Doug, that are going to love him, in some way like I love him, that are going to cherish him in the way that I do, that are going to hold him when he skins his knee or falls down, that are going to be patient when he struggles to learn things, that are going to help him learn how to be in proper relationship with other people around him, that are going to teach him how to pray to me, right? All of the weight of those things. God could search every single heart, and he sat down and he looked and he said, Mary, yes. Joseph, yes. So there's a significance about that relationship that he's kind of called out and chosen in that. I want to fill you in a little bit on marriage in that time and day, because it's a little different than ours, and give you a little bit of cultural background on that. So marriage in that time had three different core components to it. The engagement is the first of those kinds of things. And the engagement occurs often when they are little itty-bitty children. You know, it could be 3, 4, 5, 6, somewhere in that range. And parents get together and they're like, I would like our families to be connected. You've got a kid about the same age as mine. He seems reasonably healthy and somewhat intelligent. You've got a good career. I mean, whatever it is that you match together at that stage as parents, when you have a little bit more wisdom and you're like, okay, we are engaging our kids together. At that stage, it's a little bit of an informal arrangement as the kids grow older, as the families mature, and we all know how that happens, right? Sometimes the great relationships that occurred 5 or 6 years later on, somebody's cow dies somewhere else, or somebody does something to somebody somewhere else, they're like, we're done with you, right? So this relationship could be broken by either party, either the kids as they grew older, or the parents along the way, without any legal ramifications whatsoever. It's like a handshake deal. If you walk away from it, you're like, all right, I'll find someone else, right? So a little bit of a connecting kind of thing, not too much. Following after that, then, is the betrothal, which is when that becomes a little bit more serious or committed. This is a formal commitment then. From this point on, and it lasts around a year, sometimes a little bit less, sometimes a little bit longer, they are known as husband and wife. That's the way they're called around town, right? So she's already kind of taken his last name. They're known. They didn't do that back then, but that's the idea, right? They're known in that way. They're publicly presented as husband and wife together. However, they do not live together. They don't share the rights of marriage together. The opportunities of marriage that are presented on a physical level are not present for them at all. But the only way to break it once you enter into this stage is out of a divorce, which is the weird thing for us, right? We hear about Joseph thinking, should I divorce her or not? But you're not married yet. It's a different setup for them, right? If you're engaged, you know, when you have a wedding coming up and you break it off, you don't have to go through any legal issues, right? You just walk away. I mean, I may have a lot of emotional issues, but no legal ones coming from that. For those, it was a legal divorce that would have occurred, even if you were just betrothed, had no connections physically whatsoever. So there's numerous examples from Jewish writings of Jewish girls who were at the betrothal stage, and their fiancé died for some reason, whatever it is, accident, whatever it was. And she was thereafter known and referred to as a virgin who is a widow. Which is like incomprehensible in our society, etc., but they have that extra stage in the middle. So that would happen. If you died, then you were known as a widow because you had been betrothed, but you're a virgin because you hadn't had all those rites come into play. And then finally, then we have the marriage proper as we're used to it. There is a wedding that precedes that. They have the full rites. They move in together. They live together. They produce kids together, if that's possible, etc. on from there, right? So those three things go together. So we see in verse 18, I think it is, that Mary is pledged to Joseph, which means they're at the betrothal stage, right? So they have a formal commitment. These two are getting together. They have some date in the future where a wedding is being prepared and planned for. They are referred to as husband and wife around town, etc. They don't have any connection. They don't live together. And this is where we pick up kind of this core story for Joseph. At least the core one to look at today. I want to laser in just on a couple verses, verse 19 and 20. As we look at Joseph for today, that's a lot of other stories to look at, but just want to dig into these for right now. As we look at this, I want you to grab this setting for Joseph, right? He's in that betrothal stage. Maybe they were engaged for a long time. Now he says, this is the one. I'm looking forward to that. And however it came about, right, evidence is presented that Mary is pregnant. whether she went and told him herself, whether it just kind of showed, whether whatever it is, right? Everybody's aware that this is what's going on. And then we capture Joseph in this obviously key and significant moment, right? Anytime you're getting married, that's a huge life experience for you. Anytime you feel like you have been betrayed, which is the honest feeling he has, right? You have to give total freedom for Joseph in this, because at no time ever in human history before that had anyone ever been pregnant without doing what we know leads to pregnancy, right? So his natural assumption is not flawed. It's not wrong on any level, right? I mean, he had no reason to suspect anything other than that Mary has betrayed the relationship that we've been committed to. So out of Joseph in this moment, there are these qualities that are revealed in him, right? The first one is that Joseph is a man of obedience. He understands that there is a law that God has that is proper and good, and that when you sin against that law, there are natural consequences. He's got that first mountain set. He knows what those things mean. He knows what it means to commit adultery. That seems to be what's happened in this situation. We've been committed to each other, and you become pregnant by something else. So he understands that and needs to address that. But then as he goes on, we see that he's also this man of compassion and righteousness. Right? I love how that next phrase kind of rolls out, because most of us assume that righteousness is all about the first mountain over there. The righteousness is all about doing the right kind of thing. And there is an aspect of that. But listen to what it says. It says in verse 19, because Joseph, her husband, was a righteous man and did not want to expose her to public disgrace. You see, that righteousness is a second mountain righteousness. It's not a righteousness that says, you know, whether you did the right thing or not. It says, I know that some sin, at least in his awareness at that moment, has occurred, but I don't want to wound you. I want to come at you with grace. I want to comfort you when you're hurting. I want to be compassionate and tender, not because you deserve it. You just stomped on my heart. Right? This is a quality in the man that is absolutely amazing. That is absolutely incredible. That at that intimate level of betrayal, again, we know it didn't happen, but that was his awareness in the moment. That's why we're sticking on those two verses. What he knew in that moment was, my most intimate relationship has been betrayed. And I respond not with anger, not with hatred, not like I am bringing your dirty laundry all over this town. Right? With this most amazing righteousness. That says that even my enemies I want good for. And I want to find a way that whatever consequences need to happen, I want to find a way to give you as much grace in that moment as I can. Right? There is a righteousness that comes. And then in verse 20, we find that Joseph is thoughtful about this. The NIV translation is maybe not the strongest at this point. It says, but after. That word can be translated differently. I think the best consideration is that while he was considering this, right? If it was after, he would have already publicly divorced her. The thing is that this situation for Joseph is a messy one. Not only because his own heart is in it, but because he's concerned about Mary's heart. In her life, in his experience, he's wrestling and thinking, that's probably where I'm going to go, but he hasn't actually done it yet. Because he knows that people are involved, and he knows that there's going to be hurt in that. And so he's slow and taking his time to say, how am I going to respond in this moment? What's the right way to go? It is amazing to see someone willing to take their time in that. Amazing to see someone willing to consider the feelings of somebody who's hurt you so much. Like, truly incredible insight into who this man is. Now, we know that right after that, God comes to Joseph in a dream, right? And he says, hey, Joseph, it's okay. What Mary has said to you, she's not crazy. It's actually really true. She has not betrayed you. She has not turned her back on you. She is faithful, and you can walk into that relationship without your heart being wounded, trusting in me. And I'm going to do something good and beautiful. I'm going to save the world through what's going to go on and happen here. Right? But that happens in verse 21. And I want to just stop at verse 20 for a second. Because we see something incredible in that moment. And sometimes we look at the whole story, we miss the little moments of these things. So here is this snapshot of Joseph. When nobody is looking. Right, this is just inside his own head. Nobody else around him, he's not aware that in future generations, like billions of people will examine his life. Right, he is a Jewish teenager at this moment, has no awareness of that whatsoever. Right, so this is just honest, core, at the heart level, this is Joseph. Right, this is who you are when no one is looking. And that is the truest and deepest understanding of who you truly are. So Jenny, you can show the next picture there. Jenny, you want to go ahead one? There we go. You are who you are when no one is looking. You are who you truly are when no one else is looking. All right, we all understand that being supervised or having others look changes our behavior, right? If you look behind you and you notice no flashing lights but a police car, and you watch everything. Like, you might have gone a couple miles more over. I'm bringing it right down. Like, it all happens, right? You know, a boss is coming to your meeting, right? And it changes some of the way you interact among others. You might be having a heated discussion with your spouse, but have one of your kids come into that. Like, suddenly open the door and come in, and suddenly it changes things, right? Someone else is watching what's going on, and so I change my behavior. We all do those kinds of things. The challenging thing is to be able to say, when no one else is examining my life, when no one else is holding me accountable or looking inside, who am I at the core? Who am I really? If no one is watching you and you walk by trash, do you pick it up? You don't have to answer for me. Because you can answer publicly and it doesn't matter. What matters is what you really do. Right? If no one is watching and it doesn't ever show up on your taxes or anywhere else, are you as generous when no one else ever finds out what you do? When you have time and it's absolutely unaccountable, no one else knows what you're doing with it or what you're doing, where do you invest yourself? Who are you truly? Do you pray as much when no one else watches or knows? Do you read the Bible as much when no one else watches or knows? Right? Who are you at the deepest part of you? It's a hard question for us to answer. Because the honest thing is that once we start looking, we start correcting our behavior. And we start changing what we do. Because now we're examining ourselves, and that's enough to begin to make that change too. Who are you at the core when no one else is looking in your life at all? Maybe that question is a little scary. Maybe it's a little hard to get into. It's kind of uncertain what we'll find when we look into that. I want to revisit one more truth for you before we kind of tie that up. Is there ever a time when no one is looking? No. We basically fool ourselves to think that. We imagine when there's no human beings around us that no one is looking. We imagine that what occurs inside our head, which no other human being has any awareness of what we think about others or what we say about them or how we judge them in our mind, right? We think no one is looking, but the reality is someone is. Right? God is always aware. Now, if we ask the question, apart from God, who are you at your core? And invite you to look inside your life and say, when you're not accountable at all, what do you do? What do you think? What do you invest in? Our tendency, if you're at all, your humanity matches mine at all, is probably to veer more toward a negative side. Here's where I am selfish when I'm alone. Here's where I am judgmental of others when my thoughts are stuck inside my head. And the things that I can think about them up here, I'd never say out loud, but I can think them up here, right? Our tendency is to move into the negative. But it's only when we bring God into that equation that we can honestly see who we truly are. Because our own view is skewed as well. But there is this beautiful opportunity, even necessity, to know yourself through the eyes of God. We are not here to make Joseph into some amazing saint who never had flaws and never messed up and never failed. Right? That's not who he was. God chose Joseph, and we saw some of the amazing qualities that would make you say, if I had to have someone watch over my kid, if they could be obedient, have that kind of compassion and thoughtfulness for others, okay, if I have to do that, I'm in on that. But God equally knew all the flaws in Joseph. He knew the selfishness in that man. He knew the anger or fear or lust or whatever else might find his way into his heart. Right? And so God knew him perfectly, just as God knows us perfectly. He'll find not only the weaknesses in you that when you dig down to it are there as well, but also the goodness and the strength and the beauty inside of you. And so far more important than you asking the question, who am I when no one is ever looking, is to begin to ask that question of God, who do you see that I truly am? And he will bring out whatever challenges need to be brought out, but also whatever goodness is there too. I want to invite you as we get ready for communion to take a minute or two right now just to come to God with that question. Who do you see that I truly am? Take off all your masks, take off everything else that you imagine or want others to think is true about you. When you burn all that stuff away, and you burn away even your own presumptions or hopes or dreams or fears, and you just come naked before God and say, who do you see? Because you see it all that I truly am. Come to him now. Jesus, I pray this is a question we bring to you more than just in this moment. And I pray that you come to us with your truth, able to overwhelm, God, all the condemnation and guilt and fear and shame, able to overcome, God, just misunderstandings of ourself, voices brought from others around us. God, I pray that every one of us in this life, and it may take time to get there, but that every one of us could know ourselves truly as you know us. And that you build a relationship, God, of enough safety that we can hear that from you and receive that from you. Father, I thank you for this promise of communion. That there is this God at work in us, making us to be the man or woman that you have created us to be. So in this moment, Jesus, again come and enter us. Again come and own us and reveal ourselves to us, that we might see ourselves as you see us, and be who you're calling us to be.